Hello and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host with the odd pauses, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Odd pause, Candace LePage.
Good, good. I'm glad we're all on the same page. Candace, you like creepy things, right?
I feel like answering yes is a trick. This is a trick question. But yes, I do like creepy things.
And do you like listening to radio shows early in the morning?
Ooh, I do like listening to radio shows early in the morning.
That's good because End Credits, your local movie show for local movie fans, is here back at its new old home Wednesday at 8 a.m. And we talk the latest in pop culture and review of the newest movies, which this week is the Stephen King-based horror remake, It. So the pronouns in this one are going to be a tricky. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to tackle some movie news from the past week, including more Hollywood whitewashing, and this time it's the actor who took it upon himself to say that enough was enough. Ed Skrein politely refused a role in the Hellboy remake that was meant for an Asian actor, and we will learn more about that. And then more director drama on the Star Wars set as Colin Trevorrow, the man behind Jurassic World, is out as the director of Episode 9, and we haven't even got Episode 8 yet, but we're already replacing directors on Episode 9, so... What is the deal with Star Wars and its directors? But our first topic has to do with video games and video game movies and its genre, subgenre. I don't know where you would classify it, but this has long been the butt of insults and jokes. One filmmaker, who you may know by his work, not necessarily by his name yet, Jordan Voight Roberts. He made Kong Skull Island, which you may have seen earlier this year. He was talking about this. He made a trailer for a video game, Destiny 2. I've heard the name. I'm not a big gamer, but I'm more of the Destiny franchise. So he made this commercial. He's talking about video game movies, and he thinks he has the answer. And I can't help but think, like, this is this comes out every now and then. People talk about video game movies, and it seems like what you got to do is respect the genre and respect the video games, and then
You end up with Hardcore Henry.
And then you end up with Hardcore Henry, which wasn't a video game movie per se, because it wasn't based on a video game.
It did respect the genre, though.
Well, that's just the thing. It was a video game movie in type. It even had a character who was killed and kept coming back. Mm-hmm. So it was a video game movie, and it seems weird that it takes like these, even something like Scott Pilgrim versus the World as well. Mm-hmm. You could almost make an argument it is a video game movie because it plays into all the little memes and tropes, and you see he has power bars and he gets one ups and
definitely felt like a 2D scrolling game.
So it seems like if you want to be a great video game movie, don't be based on a video game.
That's, mind blown. Yeah, this is it's a tricky thing, and I do completely understand why people talk about it, why it bubbles up to the surface every once in a while, and why we continue to get Hollywood studios buying licenses for these immense game properties and then not being able to do anything with it, because it's super challenging. And what's interesting is I think a lot of people talk about how games are almost the height of entertainment right now and the height of storytelling. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody can really put their finger on why, because clearly it doesn't work in a movie medium to tell a story the way a video game does. Mm-hmm. And it's because it really puts the story in your own hands. It's like your own choose your own adventure sort of thing, which I think they've tried that in a movie as well. I feel like on YouTube sometimes you can find these things where you get these choose your own adventure type deals.
Well, I know Francis Ford Coppola did a movie, one of his experimental movies in the last couple of years, where it was he would re-edit the movie as it was playing, where he had like a variety of options
depending on what the audience was.
All right, I guess, or just what he felt like that day. But, the experiment has been done, it's not the method and the medium doesn't necessarily translate from one to the other. You can do a choose-your-own-adventure thing. Something like YouTube would make it pretty easy, but in a big screen movie, that's obviously presents a bit more difficulty and challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the secret is. I know this guy who he did the trailer for Destiny 2, right? And I think what's interesting is I find advertisements and trailers for games to be just amazing, mm-hmm. like absolutely amazing. I feel like trailers for video games and music videos are basically sort of, they're very similar. They have the same sort of artistic style, and that the person who does one really well can probably do the other really well.
Mm-hmm.
I do find it interesting, though, because I find generally speaking that the trailers for video games, of course, don't have any gameplay in them whatsoever. So maybe he is the right type of person to talk about this, because he knows how to take a gameplay and make a story out of it in a smaller way. Maybe he's the right type of person who can come along and make that into a, you know, an 80-minute long piece.
Yeah, I do question some of the basis of his argument, though, because he says, like, you need people who've grown up with video games to come and make these movies. It's like, well, at this point,
yeah,
the people in their prime making movies did grow up with video games.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking back at 40 years ago, you know, that was arcade, that was Pong, that was Atari 2600, Commodore 64 territory.
Yeah.
You know, and then in a couple of years, the people who are playing, you know, Nintendo, like straight out of the box, first generation, those people will be 40. So the people who grew up playing video games are the people now working in the movie industry. And, you know, but perhaps it is a higher up thing. Perhaps it is, it's, you know, it's a leap that studio people need to make. That this isn't like adapting a book or even adapting like a comic book, because there was that same thing too with comic books, where there's just, you know, you look between, like, say, Superman the movie released in 78 and Iron Man released in 2008. That's 30 years. And how many good to great comic book movies, not even great, just good comic book movies, were released in that 30-year span?
Are you implying that Howard the Duck is not an amazing comic book movie?
Yes.
What about The Shadow?
You know what? I have a fondness for The Shadow. I think it's one of the early Alec Baldwin's where it just shows how completely bat-ass he is.
He's pretty bonkers.
So he, like, leans into that hard in that movie, and Russell McCauley, you know, he made The Highlander, so I think he's one of these directors who doesn't get a lot of respect and maybe should get a little bit more respect for his B-movie skills.
But that's a B-movie and not a comic book movie. I mean, I think you're right. Like, there was a huge spell there in the 80s and most of the 90s where comic book movies were just, they were a joke.
Yeah. And, you know, we could add as well that the technology, you know, made it easier to be able to translate those stories. And maybe there needs to be some sort of technological leap, you know, maybe, you know, having live action characters in a video game movie doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe this is a direction motion capture can go into. Imagine if there was like a sort of Beowulf or Tintin Field, like Assassin's Creed movie.
You know, there's also the other argument too about the frames per second, right? I think most video games are at 60 frames per second, whereas most movies are at like 28 or something like that, right? And I know that The Hobbit, which came out at what, 40 frames per second? Was that?
It was 48. It was 48. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And that didn't really, I think, go very well.
No.
It didn't have the impact that people wanted it to. And I haven't seen any other movies coming out at a higher frame rate.
No.
But some people who were into video games were a little bit excited about this opportunity. It's like, maybe that's part of what's going to be the thing to make a video game movie actually feel like a video game.
And I think that's key. Although I did mention Assassin's Creed, and having recently watched Assassin's Creed, again, I'm not a big gamer, so I've never played the Assassin's Creed game, but I hated that movie. It was, and it had nothing to do with, like, the concept. The concept was interesting, but, you know, I've heard people who played the game talk, and it's like, it spent too much time in, like, the modern world and the real world. It's like, yeah, that's part of it. It's like the ancestors have the knowledge of the past lives and stuff, but when you're in the game, you don't spend all your time in the modern day sitting around talking about the skill you have. You do at the beginning, and then you go back in time and play as the past character. And I also heard the same argument about Warcraft. Like, a lot of people who liked playing World of Warcraft, like the Warcraft movie, because it was, from what I gather, like a prequel to the where the game
okay.
is.
Yep.
Where it gave a lot of background, but I watched that movie too, and I was just like, no. I don't care about orgs. I don't care about wargs or mages or whatever the heck is going on here. It's
And to be fair, I haven't watched either of those movies or played either of those games, because neither one of the, like, I certainly played a lot of games in the 80s and 90s growing up, and I would probably say that Mortal Kombat was my favorite game of the 80s, and I think the movie was fun. It was fun.
Yeah.
Right? And I would say most people would probably consider Mortal Kombat to be a fairly good video game movie.
I think it would probably make the list of the best, it's one of the best, if not the best. And I mean, there's not a lot of competition. But I mean, that was something. You have another B movie director, Paul W.S. Anderson. You have like a relatively simple concept in that it's people go to an island and fight, and he didn't, you know, try to
jam story in there.
Yeah, he didn't try to build like any kind of like super complicated mythology or into it or have to overly explain stuff. At the beginning, everyone gets this invitation to come to this island and fight, and then they fight.
Yeah.
And then that's all there is to it. And it's like an hour and a half long. You're in and you're out.
Yeah, and I do think that's part of the problem with the video game movies is that the story of a video game, saving a few, you know, things like Halo, which are just these giant world-building sort of things, the actual story in the game itself is probably maybe 15 minutes of story. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a short film, and it's set up so that in between you're getting the gameplay. Mm-hmm. And the gameplay part is either fighting or shooting or racing or whatever, which I think a lot of people will tend to look at a movie like a Transformers movie, for instance, where it's, oh, there's 2 minutes of story to get to the 15 minutes of, you know, big action and then 2 minutes. And people deride that about, oh, you know, we want this and we want that and we want this. And it's just like someone's, they're either not selling it to the right audience or they're probably doing something that would work for a video game movie and giving it to things that probably should have story instead.
Mm-hmm. And there is structure to a video game too. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts off simply and then, you know, it gets more complicated as it goes on. You do different levels, which, you know, gets you different pieces of information. You start a new level. It's like, okay, on this level, these are the rules, and you have to do this accomplishment in order to get to the next level. And, you know, I hate the old, this is a refrain a lot, that, you know, this movie doesn't work, it would be better as a TV show. I hear that far too often now. But one of the most successful video game adaptations of the last few years was the Mortal Kombat web series. And I wonder if perhaps that's where the format should go. Whether maybe, and Castlevania on Netflix, that's another recent successful adaptation. So, you know, are we maybe being too ambitious? Maybe video games could conquer a more TV or web series realm before. And then once you sort of conquer that transition to a different type of storytelling like that, which complements the video game, then you can figure out the next thing, which is to take it to the movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and maybe that comes back to, we make really good 2 or 3 minute long trailers for video games. And jumping from 2 to 3 minutes all the way to 80 or 90 minutes is maybe a little too far a jump.
And before leaving this topic, I want to compliment Jordan Vogt Roberts, because I wanted to make sure I pronounced his name right. Mm-hmm. And so I searched YouTube for him. And the first thing that comes up is the Honest Trailer for Kong Skull Island. Mm-hmm. And he actually took part in that.
Oh, good for him.
So he's at least he has a sense of humor about himself. Probably also has someone who has a sense of humor about himself. Ed Skrein, who's, you know, people will know him best, I think, from Deadpool. He was the villain in Deadpool, Francis. I don't think that was the character's name. That was Deadpool's nickname for him, but that's not here nor there. But he was cast to play a Japanese-American character named Ben Damo in a remake of Hellboy. And Ben Damo, if you know the comic book origins of Hellboy, is a Japanese-American character. Ed Skrein is not Japanese-American, neither Japanese nor American. So there was obviously immediate backlash, and he, to his credit, said, no, I was not aware of that for the character, and I'm taking myself out of this. Mm-hmm. And someone in Variety wrote about this, and I think they made a good point. It's like there's been this blowback over the last several years. And, you know, we've had social media boycotts. We've had people writing think pieces and finger wagging from you know, tastemakers and the cultural quote unquote elites. I think it, you know, and their point, and I think it's valid, is that it's going to be upon the actors themselves to say, mm-hmm. no, this is a Japanese-American part. I am not Japanese-American. Go and find a Japanese-American.
Yeah, and so this is the first thing I do want to say is that Ed Skrein wasn't cast to play a Japanese-American. He was cast to play the character of Ben Damo.
Yeah.
Who was just written on the page as this guy who does whatever. So what happened is that either the producers, the director, the casting director, even maybe the screenwriter of mm-hmm. this piece of artwork, at no point felt that it was important
right.
that character actually be Japanese-American.
Yeah.
And maybe it isn't important. Maybe it actually has nothing to do with any of his character motivations. There's literally nothing in the things that this character is doing that make his being a mixed-race Japanese-American a character trait which needs to be honored.
Mm-hmm.
And only, I think, white people can understand why, like, would think that way.
Mm-hmm.
That, oh, well, it doesn't, I mean, nothing in the story says anything about him being Japanese, so it doesn't really matter. Because we see each other everywhere we go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So representation to us doesn't really matter that much. So at every level, all of these people just never thought about how important it was for him to be Japanese-American, because it's not part of the story. So I don't want to say they did nothing wrong. They did something very understandable, because we just don't think that way.
And I want to note that I just looked up the character, mm-hmm. and he's like some sort of were-jaguar. He was like a U.S. Marine who becomes a were-jaguar.
That's amazing.
So it's it's not really Japanese-centric.
So at no point did anyone like maliciously choose to do something. They just, through our own ignorance and through our own privilege, just didn't realize that this was important.
That's right.
What happened, of course, is that people who do believe it's important, that they see themselves on the screen, thought, no, hold on a second. Like, I want to see me up there. And so made a big fuss about it. And Ed Skrein is the hero of the story, basically, who said, oh, I get it. I understand why this is important. I will step away.
Right.
And he didn't realize it either. Like, he didn't go in there reading a casting thing saying, Japanese-American doing this. And he went,
that's right.
I can nail that. Look at me.
Yeah. I can so be Japanese.
Yeah. And so this is the problem, is that he's the only person, and I don't want to say the only person, but he is the person who in this whole thing said, oh, I made a mistake out of ignorance, and I'm going to fix it. Rather than everybody else, and there have been a lot of people recently who have been told, hey, by the way, it's actually important that this person be played by someone who is of this ethnicity. And they go, oh, well, I didn't make that mistake. That was someone else. Or I just need the role. Or who even knows?
Right.
It's not that hard to just say, oh, I made a mistake and I'm going to fix it. And now we know.
And the thing is, he could need a role. This, like, he's not Brad Pitt where he can get just like, you know, he doesn't have a job. Okay, there's five other job offers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a well-known actor.
I'm sure
actor.
There will be now, though.
Well, yeah, he was in a very popular movie, but he's a working actor, too. You know, like I said, he's not a Brad Pitt figure where, you know, because he's available and you know, he'll just be picked up like that. So he is losing work by doing this. And he could have very easily said, oh, I'm just like a working actor and I went for a part and this is what happened. And I do feel like there's too much trying to justify it, even in, like, business terms. And and what we're seeing is that the business terms don't make sense.
No.
Because you had Ridley Scott, who was blasted for doing Exodus, Gods and Kings, and having white people play Egyptians, as has been the style in 100 years of Hollywood. And he's like, well, I can't, like, do a $100 million movie and get, like, all these tax credits and make a big budget blockbuster with, you know, I think he literally said Muhammad what's his name.
Oh my god, really?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
But then
he knows that there are like billions of people named Muhammad what's his name, right? Like, it's the most common name in the world.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what he was getting at, but he could have been less of a dick about it. But But that movie tanked. And then it was the same thing with Ghost in the Shell. It's like, we're going to hire Scarlett Johansson to play a Japanese character because she's a mega star and she's known worldwide and it'll bring people in because they know when they see Scarlett Johansson, she's great at kicking ass. And then that bombs.
Yep.
And so the question becomes for these producers is, if your justification is the only way you can make money is by hiring name actors who are white and the movies still bomb, why don't you just hire the racially particular mm-hmm. actor for the role? And if it bombs, it bombs because it was a bad movie or because yeah. people didn't want to see it or whatever. But then you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because last time I was on the show, we talked about Death Note, which, yeah. of course, some people have really complained that it's been whitewashed. And we didn't really talk about that so much because I do think that there's a difference between whitewashing and Americanizing.
Right.
And so basically they just took a Japanese story and set it in America. And I don't really feel that they whitewashed it. They did actually have a diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than making everybody Japanese and setting it all in Japan, they just made everybody American, set it all in America,
right.
but then still had diversity in their cast just, you know, because that's what the makeup of America looks like. So I do think there is a difference between what has happened here, which is,
right.
you know, casting a specifically racial character as white
mm-hmm.
versus changing a whole story to happen in a different place.
Right. There is a difference between that, too. And I would also try and argue that there is a difference between what happened with Doctor Strange and with making the Ancient One a white woman versus an older Asian man. Because I remember hearing the debates, and I don't necessarily discount anything with the debates, but mm-hmm. I feel that was a damned if they do, damned if they don't situation.
Yeah.
They could change the character, or they could, and then get blasted for that. Or they can make it an old Asian guy and get blasted for leaning into the stereotype.
Yeah, the stereotype. Yeah.
Even though there was another Asian character in that who they did alter to make him less of a stereotype. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, yeah, there's a spectrum to these things. And I'm glad Ed Skrein, you know, made the call that he did. And mm-hmm. I hope, you know, there's, you know, people see that and realize, and not just the producers, and realize mm-hmm. like, oh, geez, we're like turning off actors, but other actors themselves realize you can take a stand and it can be morally correct and you will get recognized.
Absolutely.
For it.
And you know what? The reality is that we don't think that we can do that. I was actually yeah. in an experience where I was standing with two other women and people were setting people up for a photo opportunity and came to us and said, oh, do you guys want to come up and stand here so that you can be in the photo? And we looked at each other and then looked at the photo. And one of the three of us, who was not me, but one of the other women said, I don't think you need three more white women in this photo. Mm. And I just went, oh my God, you can say that. You can totally say that. You're so right. You don't need three more white girls in this photo. I think there are better people in this crowd for you to have in the photo. I was like,
yeah.
I mean, it's mind-blowing. I'm 40 years old, and I've just realized that as a white person, I can say, no, you don't. I don't need to represent
yep.
more of my culture right now.
Well done. I don't know if this is doing anything about the culture, but, you know, another white man losing his job, but we'll may have to wait and see. We'll talk about this briefly, but, you know, you've been following along with Star Wars news, and why haven't you? It's clearly the most important news. But Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World, he was supposed to direct Episode 9 of Star Wars. He has been fired. There's no ambiguity about this, like certain people at the White House recently, but sorry, I had to get a political thing in here. But he was fired. Everyone agrees he was fired. This is, you know, the third director to be fired from there. We had Phil Lord and Chris Miller earlier this year off the Star
Han
Wars
Solo
prequels.
Oh.
The Han Solo prequel.
Yep.
Yep, you're right. And then before that, Josh Trank, who directed the Fantastic Four movie and the Chronicle, was fired after Fantastic Four came out. He was supposed to direct, I don't know if he was supposed to direct the Han Solo or if he was supposed to direct some other Star Wars spinoff, but mm-hmm. he was supposed to direct the Star Wars movie. He was out. A lot of people are blaming this on the fact that Colin Trevorrow just made a movie that kind of bombed. It was called The Book of Henry. I don't think it ever made it to Guelph. I'm not sure if it's on demand right now, so we can check it out in another way. But apparently it's because he's difficult to work with, and Star Wars is bigger than any one director, and that is becoming more and more clear.
Yeah, so let me preface this by saying I really don't care about Star Wars anymore. Like, honest to God, could they just let this thing die? Like, I feel like the world's worst Star Wars fan, but I just have zero interest and zero excitement about any of these movies. You know, I think we started with three really good movies, and then someone who thought they were bigger than the story decided that there was more story to tell, and there maybe wasn't necessarily. And I just, like, I just feel like they're trying to...
I didn't hate the Ewok TV movies as much as you, but yeah.
I really enjoyed the Ewok TV movies. I still have them both on VHS tape.
Oh, wow. You are hardcore.
Yeah, it was good stuff, man. But yeah, I just feel like, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was already... I mean, I love George Lucas. God, I do love George Lucas. But I already thought that this property was sort of in the hands of a tyrant. And then he sold it to Disney, and it's like, wow, Disney is even more, like, they won't let the story breathe, they won't let it, it's like, no, we own this, and this is what we want it to do.
Right.
And I guess there's nothing wrong with that. You hire people and say, we want you to do this, but I think they maybe need to be clearer on their hiring practices, because this is happening over and over and over again, where they're bringing in directors who are really good at what they do, and then the director starts doing what they do, and they go, oh, no, we don't want you to do that.
Right.
We want you to do this. It's like they need to... I think Disney is really working hard to sort of reinstate the studio system of the early 1900s.
Yeah.
That might be what they need to do, right?
And, you know, it's... Given the amount of money they invest in this property and how much money they... I mean, they've probably made that money back five times over by now. And they bought Lucasfilm for $4 billion, but...
The dramatic amount of money.
But it's, well, to George Lucas's credit, he's given a lot of it back because he's building a film history museum in L.A. Yep. So it's, you know, he's not all tyrant. He's,
and
he's
I don't mean tyrant
with a heart of gold.
It's a person. I mean tyrant on, like, this is my story and it goes like this.
Right. And I think that's really important, is that they want to hire, like, these names. I mean, Colin Trevorrow, I was not a fan of Jurassic World. It was, like, the most... bland, straightforward way you could have brought that franchise back. And it was successful, to his credit. But somebody like Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who, like, have a voice and have a style and have accomplishments. Somebody like Josh Trank, who, again, someone who was allegedly difficult on the set of Fantastic Four, but he made a small movie that was incredibly successful called Chronicle. So clearly,
so good.
It was really, really good. So, you know, you're seeing the skills on screen. You want to invest in the skills, but you don't like the way they do it, or they're not doing something that you think the way it should be. So you have one of two choices. You can either go what they've been doing, which is to just sweep everyone aside to do exactly what they want from a studio perspective, or you can step back and wait, and then maybe that movie's going to fail. I think the real test of this is going to be with the Star Wars The Last Jedi, which is from Rian Johnson. And he's one of these other people who has, like, a very particular voice, a very particular style. So it's kind of surprising.
That he had... I know. That's what I've been thinking. Like, how is Rian Johnson holding on to this job? Because he has a very specific style. And I worry that what's going to happen is that they're just going to be putting out a bunch of bland Star Wars films. I mean, I did find that A Force Awakens was bland. Like, it was good. It was an enjoyable movie. I felt like I could have been watching any other summer blockbuster, you know, like it, except it was Christmas, but but that's the thing. Like, it didn't feel like Star Wars to me. It just felt like a sci-fi action flick.
But I think that was a proof of concept that it can be done without Lucas, that it can be done in a way that will make audiences excited without carrying the baggage of the prequels. It was, we can do this kind of thing. But that movie made, like, $3 billion. So, you know, I think when you make $3 billion, you can loosen the reins a bit for whoever comes next and what they can do. Maybe that's what's happened to Rian Johnson, or maybe because of Rian Johnson's TV experience. He's just better at negotiating between different creative sets of people and is able to thread the needle, which maybe the Trevorrows and the Tranks, being more film-centric directors, can't do.
Now, wasn't he originally supposed to do both of the next films, 8 and 9? Did he just decide it was too much work?
That is a curious thing, because he said he was brought in only to do 8. I think the initial report said he was going to do, like, some sort of story outline or write the screenplay for 9. if I remember that correctly. So, I mean, who knows what happens now? I mean, we saw what happened with Han Solo. They replaced it with Ron Howard. And I like Ron Howard. Great work. Great, you know, sort of journeyman director. But he's no Artur.
No, and sci-fi / Star Wars. I mean, I guess he has done some, well, I don't know if you can call Apollo 11 sci-fi, but
well, it's not fi, it's sci.
It's sci. But
that's another debate for another day. We're going to take a break and then come back with our review of It. And because I think that's going to be a heavy one. A lot of creepy crawlies and stuff. And so, you know what? Let's get a little peppy before that and drive to a little Motown. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
All the bad things that happen in this town are because of one thing, an evil thing that feeds off the people of Derry.
But it can't be one thing. We all saw something different.
Maybe. Or maybe it knows what scares us most, and that's what we see.
I saw a leper. He was like a walking infection.
But you didn't. Because it isn't real. None of this is. None of this makes any sense. They're all like bad dreams.
I don't think so. I know the difference between a bad dream and real life, okay? We're all afraid of something.
Got that right. Hi, Rich. What are you afraid of? Clowns.
And you'll be afraid of clowns, too, when you see It, which is a new film from Andy Muschietti, and it is based on the popular movie by Stephen King. It stars Jaden Lieberher, Jeremy Ray Taylor, Sophia Lillis, Finn Wolfhard, Chosen Jacobs, Jack Dylan Grazer, Wyatt Olef, and, of course, Bill Skarsgård as the titular clown. Candace, you are the horror buff of the panel.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us your It thoughts.
Well, I promised I wouldn't gush too much. That was my rule. I'm like, oh my God, I have to relax. I can't gush too much. But it was good.
maybe we could gush a little more.
I'm a huge fan of Stephen King. I read all of his books growing up. I stopped sometime in the mid 90s when things started getting kind of repetitive. But
the lamp monster.
I don't. What?
That was a Family Guy bit. Where
was like the lamp monster. Which one was that? Dolores Claiborne?
That's a Family Guy bit where he's like, I have a movie about a lamp monster.
Yeah.
When can we have it?
The most inane things are very scary.
That's right.
So I'm a huge Stephen King fan. I hadn't read It when the miniseries came out yet. So I saw the miniseries before reading the book. So certainly I absolutely loved the miniseries, and it definitely affected how much I loved the book because I sort of, you know, was applying a lot of what I loved about the miniseries into the book. The book is by far better than the miniseries, but also by far worse than the miniseries because there's some stuff that's, thank God they left it out of the original miniseries. Thank God they also left it out of this adaptation, I'll call it. Because there are some really, like, they did a really good job in this film of keeping what It is far more streamlined, more understandable.
Yes.
Basically, it's just a thing. It feeds off our fear. Yep. I mean, I think that's a really simple thing that could have been what it was in the book, and there was a whole lot of other stuff, which is really weird. I don't know if that'll come out in chapter two. By
Maybe.
The way, spoiler alert, this is only the first part of a two-part story, which I knew, obviously, because I was a big fan of the book. I think a lot of people who are fans of the book obviously knew that this was just one of two, because clearly they've only cast all the kids and stuff like that. Because we do get the story of the adults when this happens again. But I liked being in the audience, because there were certainly people, there were a lot of people there as I'm looking at people coming in going, how many of these people have never read the book, never seen the miniseries, have no idea what they're in for whatsoever.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen when, you know, and that's how it is. Like, chapter two will come.
I was in a full house on Saturday night, and it comes up at the end, you know, like the title card, and it says chapter one, and people are like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, like, there were a couple of, like, damn.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I think it was a shrewd move to make it, like, all about the kids, to make one movie all about the kids. And I've never read the book. But I did see the TV miniseries, and I saw it for the first time fairly recently. And by far the weakest part of that was the adults. The kids' stuff was far more engaging. And I don't know whether it was because of, like, the fact they had, like, mostly sitcom actors playing the adults.
Yeah.
You know, they had Tim Reed from WKRP and John Ritter from, from Three's Company and Harry the Hat from Night Court and... you know, Richard Thomas with the world's worst ponytail from, you know, he's from the Waltons. Yeah. So they have five sitcom actors and the guy from the Waltons. And then looking back on the kids in that miniseries too, you had Seth Green.
Yes.
And Jonathan Brandis, RIP. Emily Perkins from Ginger Snaps.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's interesting seeing all these people as youngins. But yeah, I found it, I loved every minute of it.
Yes.
It was scary in both ways, with the character, Pennywise the Clown. Mm-hmm. But it was also scary just in, like, the real world stuff, the bullies and the creepy adults. Like, almost every adult in the world of it, it's totally told from the kids' perspective. Yep. It's scaled down to them. And almost every adult is a creep. Or is, you know, like Eddie's mom, who's, like, super overprotective, or, like, Bill, the main character, Bill's dad, who's, you know, just angry that his son is obsessed with his brother's disappearance, and, you know, how dare you miss your brother, which plays into, you know, some of the, I guess, the backstory, which is there's some sort of conspiracy about why the adults don't seem to care that so many kids go missing. But, yeah, it's great because it focuses on that kid level, and the kids feel so genuine, and the way they rag on each other, and the way they, you know, hang out, the way they talk to each other. Finn Wolfhard, who I think is probably most recognizable of the kids, because if you've seen Stranger Things, so it's oddly enough, he's in this and he's in Stranger Things, and there's obviously a thematic correlation between the two. But he was so hilarious as Richie. And it was...
See, and I don't... I think he was... That was such a missed opportunity. I'm watching the whole thing. So Richie Tozier is my... Not only, like, my favorite character from the books, but, like, one of my favorite all-time fictional characters, to the point where, like, I have stuffed animals named after him. Like, Richie Tozier, to me, I was like, oh, my God, I love Richie Tozier.
That was TMI.
Sorry. Too bad. That's what you get when you invite me. So, like, but, like, I love Richie Tozier. I love the character. And I feel like I was watching this movie and I was like, how has this happened? How is Eddie Kasprak the best character in this film? Because Eddie had the funniest lines. Eddie was absolutely the Richie Tozier of this film. Like, Richie did not, like, he's supposed to be, like, the class clown and huge and unpredictable and loud and... There was none of that was there, and he did have one really good joke, which was great, but mostly I found him to be not funny and not annoying enough. Like, neither he was,
yeah,
you know,
he wasn't annoying.
Like, he was boring. He was boring. He could have not been there.
I don't know about that. One of the things I found in the, and again, I haven't read the book, but I found in the miniseries, the Richie character is, you know, it's like his shtick is from vaudeville. Which, like, if you're watching it today, you will not, like, no one watching that miniseries today will understand all that kind of thing. So, you know, just kind of being, you know, the sarcastic Sam. And I don't know if your favorite line was the one about the beaver trapping. Like, this was...
No, but that was
the town was
a
founded
really
by Beaver Trappers. It still is, am I right? I love
no,
like,
it was oh, it was line. the shoe thing. The, oh, oh the could shoe. You imagine having to like hop around down here on just one with just one shoe? Hop, hop, hop.
That was yeah. That was that was
I
kind of
for
where
a long
the
time.
The character carried over. Yeah. So I did. I like. I think I did like all the kids. I like the Ben and Beverly.
Mm-hmm.
Like the flirtation. And she's always kind of like teasing him about liking new kids.
Yeah, that kid was smooth, right? Yeah. Like he knew what he was doing. I was really impressed because, you know, that's sort of, it's one of those things where the Ben character is actually really quite smart. He's sort of the one who is sort of the smartest, right? And we don't really get to see that. He becomes an architect as an adult, but he's got like all the engineering skills and he builds things and he's really, and not only that, he also really knows relationships and so understands all these things going on. And he didn't get as much of that in this movie, but I do think that they did make him just really kind of suave. So it kind of made up for it.
He was suave in like the kid way and, and I did love the scene where she helps him. He's attacked by the bullies, and he's bleeding. And so Beverly helps the others steal supplies, and she comes down the way, and she's like, "Oh, you sure you guys got the right stuff?" Wink. And then there's a later scene where he takes them to his house and in his bedroom where he's got like the murder board, like he's one of the Criminal Minds profilers. And
yes, yeah, I did that. I'm like, he's got a murder wall. This is great because he's the smart guy.
And then Beverly's looking around. She looks behind his bedroom door. It's a big New Kids poster. She looks
Hanging
at him.
Poster.
And then and they play the bass line from Hanging Tough, and it's so great. And there's a lot of actually really great humor in it. I've heard some people say it's kind of humorless, but. There's a lot of great humor in it.
Yeah, I think they did such a really good job of walking the line of being endearing and nostalgic, and you really care for these characters, and you know, you hope for the best for them, and it's funny, and you can put yourself in their shoes, and then these like terrifying, and not in like a jump scare sort of way, though there were a couple of jump scares, but just terrifying in like this, oh, this is awful. I need to look away from the screen before whatever happens.
And I think that kind of leads us into Pennywise. And
oh my God, he's so good.
Yeah, he was really, really good.
He was so good.
This is another member of the Skarsgård acting dynasty. Bill Skarsgård's been kind of, he's young, he's like 25. Mm-hmm. So he's been kind of building himself up. You might recognize him from like maybe a few things. One of the things that sticks out to me is he was in one of the Divergent films.
He was just in Atomic Blonde also.
He was in Atomic Blonde, but
he
was
on the East Berlin side.
I don't remember what part he was though.
Yeah, he was her contact in East Berlin.
Right, yes, so. He was that guy, yeah. But yeah, I liked him. I liked the way they used Pennywise. Mm-hmm. You sort of see him in the first scene where he's talking to the brother Georgie in the sewer grate. But then for almost an hour after that, you only catch the glimpses. He's in the background. He's in the shadows. He's behind.
You hear his voice sometimes.
Yeah, you hear his voice. And revisiting the miniseries, it was on TV on the weekend, but it's the difference. And you may not fully appreciate this given past revelations you've made on the show, but it's kind of like the difference between how Heath Ledger played the Joker in The Dark Knight and the way Jack Nicholson played the Joker in Batman 89, where the one is very flashy and the one is and very showy and the other one's much more character-driven. And I think that's where Bill Skarsgård's at in this. Mm-hmm. When you watch Tim Curry in the miniseries, it is all flash.
Yeah.
You know, he's only ever rarely in shadow. It's always like the center stage spotlight is always on him when he pops up.
Yeah, and he's intimidating in his sort of delivery of speech. Like he Tim Curry's character talked a lot.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, in an intimidating manner and sort of yelling and saying creepy things. Whereas, Skarsgård's Pennywise was just creepy. They did such a great job with the makeup.
Yeah, and it's the eye thing too, whereas his eyes are looking in different directions, which is apparently a thing Bill Skarsgård can do. It's not CGI.
Yeah.
And that was another great thing. Is a lot of it was very naturalistic. It was, you know, it was makeup. Yeah. It was puppetry effects. The leper that Richie sees that he was talking about in that clip, that was all makeup. It was like something that looked straight out of The Walking Dead.
That guy, that's an actor who has some rare genetic disease that makes his limbs just really, really long. Mm-hmm. And so he's been cast in a lot of things, like in Pan's Labyrinth as well. So his physicality is so sort of monstrous to us because it looks so different from other things. So, you know, that's great that you can use a defect. I don't like using that word, but you can use something like
use
that.
Use what you're born with. Yeah. Let's say that. So it all feels very naturalistic. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that kind of drove it home for me is it was shot in and around Toronto.
Yeah, so I felt like I was there. I'm like, I feel like I know all of these places.
Right.
Like, where have they filmed? I think I've ridden down that path by the river before. Where is that?
Yeah, and even if you haven't, it probably looks like somewhere
that
you've been. You know, there's like a shallow creek there. You go along places. Here in Guelph, there are shallow creeks that are surrounded by forest. And it could look very much like a setting in this film. So, I mean, that may be translatable. Mm-hmm. To other audiences, other places. But I think growing up around here, that felt very particular.
Yeah.
And it felt even maybe a bit scarier that
you kind
of see the place where it's happening and you can imagine yourself there.
Yeah, easily. And I think for people in sort of our age, the fact that they updated it to be the 1980s versus the late 1950s really makes it, again, the same sort of thing where, yes, I was those people. I was 12 at that time as well, and I had those experiences. And, the location being so sort of close by. And what I also liked is that everything happened in the daytime.
Yeah.
The sun was always shining,
right?
And it's just like, whoa. How can this be scary? You know, when they actually, the scene where they go to the house, you know, it's not dark in that house. It's daytime. It's dark-ish because there are no lights inside the house. But you can see the sun streaming in from outside, and it's just like you're so close to safety, really, right? But yet you're still in this place that's just terrifying. And there weren't really, and at some places we did see Pennywise in the shadows, but places like that where it was really sort of coming to a head, he was always like well lit. Like there was no hiding him. He was just right there in a place where you feel like, how is this scary? It's bright. Like I can see everything. I don't want to see everything because there you are.
Yeah, he doesn't come straight out of the darkness. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you're scanning the room and then you see something and then all of a sudden he leaps out and there he is. It's a great use of light. And the only real dark part, I think, is that beginning scene because it's raining. But even then, it's like all gray and blah. But it's the way it was shot is it makes the color of the Pennywise
yellow
face,
rain
the reds,
slicker too.
And the rain slicker, too. Yeah. It makes it sort of stick out all the more. So it's really great sort of cinematography work. And you're right, because most horror movies revel in the dark, but this is all daylight, which also adds to that kid thing, because when you're a kid, you're outside in the daylight.
Yep.
You're not outside after dark.
Yeah.
So it makes the darkness even more suspect, because generally that's where, when you're a kid, that's not where you dwell.
Yeah. And I think, too, what I really liked about this movie, and some of the changes they made from the story around how they sort of, try not to be spoilerific, but how they sort of defeat it in the end. You know, there are some really not awesome things about the book around how they defeat it. And this is a coming of age story, right? Mm-hmm. Like it really, really is. And part of the thing is here, you know, they kind of simplify Pennywise into just being this thing that feeds off of fear and literally feeds and has to, you know, eat every 27 years.
Right.
And it doesn't seem to have the same effect on certain people. And it only goes for kids because kids are so fearful. And so the coming of age being, oh, we need to realize that these things that scare us are not actually as scary.
Right.
And of course, the characters within the film who have real life terrors around them, you know, things they can't run away from, things that don't hide in the dark, things that aren't sort of in their head or make-believe, the real things that they're going to have to deal with, those are the characters who start to be less fearful first.
Right.
And it's so good because there were times when I was watching it where I was creeped out. And Pennywise was nowhere near that scene.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, this is, yeah.
Even something as simple, you know, to go back to the pharmacy scene where Beverly, you know, kind of flirts with the pharmacist. I mean, even though she's 13, but she's like, those glasses make you look like Clark Kent. And he's like, oh, well, thank you. And she's like, you know, she tries them on. And he's like, well, you look like Lois Lane. Yeah. You're like, ew!
Her and classmate's father, right?
Yeah.
It's not like he doesn't know how old she is.
That's right, too. And the audience had a visceral reaction.
Gross.
Everyone blacked at the same time when he said that. And it's as effective as any jump scare, because there were points in the movie where the audience jumps together, and that's part of the great part of like having a packed theater and seeing it in the communal experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the exact same, not the exact same reaction, but everyone reacting the same during that scene, and also a couple of scenes with Beverly's father as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene in particular, because it starts off kind of so innocent and then it turns so toxic.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the supernatural or the clown or whatever else is going on in the town. And I think it's the ordinariness of it that makes it so toxic.
Yeah. Well, and part of it too, and I think Stephen King, some people talk about Stephen King and his issue with women. He does make women characters sometimes have quite a lot of power.
Mm.
But I think he has a very sort of male reaction to women's power. He doesn't really understand where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow thinks it has something to do with the fact that we menstruate, right? We think about Carrie, and it's very similar with Beverly as well, right? Because all of the horror around Beverly is around blood.
And about her becoming, I mean, it's basically her becoming a woman, being worried about becoming a woman and what that means, particularly in relationship to her father. But you're right, that what she's doing when the guys run into her is that she's buying cats.
And it's, I do think it's really effective. I mean, I think, you know, some people do complain about Stephen King with those things, but I think that he's just being really honest in that he doesn't really understand it, and it's kind of this scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of women who are like, yeah, we don't really get it either, and it's a little scary. You're right. You know?
Sure.
And I do think they did, you know, it's a nice, they didn't make her, you know, whatever, just the girl, the tomboy who hangs out. A lot of her sort of gender and sexuality and her own coming of age is really a good part of this story as well.
Yeah, and they do a good job that she's kind of, you know, fittingly being the one girl in the group, she's kind of the most mature. She's like actually taller than most of them. So both in a physical way and in a mental way as well, and in an emotional way, she's more mature than all of them. But even at that, there's the scene where they go swimming at the quarry, and then afterward they're all like just hanging out, and she's
so good.
And it's like Young MC's Bust a Move is playing, and just the combination of the music and the, you know, the emotion, and you know, knowing what it's like to be a 13-year-old boy and being in the presence of a girl in a bathing suit for the first time, again, that goes back to knowing what it's like to be a kid and managing to put that on screen.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like these are adults trying to pretend to be kids, or like in the way it's directed or in the way it's written. It's very brought down to the kid level, which is what I think what makes it the most effective.
Yeah, and what I like about that scene too, right, is that she's completely oblivious, right? She has zero idea the power that she has
exactly
at that moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, the effect that she's having on other people.
That's right. And it's, you know, and what I liked about it too is it's, other than that scene, her being a girl in the group is never really a factor either. It's just she's part of the gang. She's part of the Losers Club. And even though there's kind of a triangle with Ben and with Bill, it's feels very much like the way that would be when you're 13, 12 or 13. And aside from those two little things, which you would understand in the midst of a group, of, you know, being the one girl in the group, it's not a big deal. They're all losers. They're all on this adventure together. And as I think one of the characters says in the miniseries, maybe it's in the book, but it's like, it's like, you know, destiny brought them together.
Yeah.
And there's a great feeling in that.
Mm-hmm. I do think one of the failings of this movie is the lack of Mike Hanlon.
Mm-hmm.
His character was really, I think they really didn't know what to do with him, because in the books, it's set in 1958, and this is, you know, a bunch of losers and whatever. And so his whole being an outcast is literally because
he's
the black kid.
Yeah.
right? And in the 80s, while that's certainly still an issue, it's not as much of an issue. And I think they you know, so much of his whole story is about being black, and they really didn't know what to do, how to modernize that so much. And I don't know that they did a very good job with it, which is fine. I mean, I know I appreciate that they didn't just, you know, oh yeah, he's a black kid, so he's...
Yeah, they didn't just write him out, but unfortunately...
They lost some stuff.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as in the movie, we do have to give Mike the short shrift because we're at the end of our of our time. I had to cue that up.
All right.
So, Candace, on the internet or other places this week, how can people find out if you have the right stuff?
I'm going to try really hard not to sing along right now. You can find me on the internet at Cinn48, that's C-I-N-N-4-8, on every medium where I might be doing karaoke to New Kids on the Block.
And I have the right stuff, or hopefully, tomorrow at 5 p.m. That's for Open Sources Guelph, and I will have a couple of new interviews there, because unfortunately Scotty Hartz is still on vacation until next week. Other than that, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca for local political news. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next time for more end credits Wednesday at 8 a.m.